Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, where our job is to help you build visibility, professional credibility, and connection with your ideal client by putting the human at the center of innovative marketing, so you can build and strengthen an engaging, enduring relationship with your ideal clients. I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm honored that you're here with me. If you haven't joined our wonderful marketing transformation community yet, go to innovabiz.co and collect your free gift as well. Do subscribe to the show and also leave a review because it helps others find us. Let's get into today's masterclass on this InnovaBuzz podcast.
There's people that watch things happen. There's people that make things happen. There's people always going, what happened? I think that a life well lived is the life where you make things happen instead of waiting for things to happen. There's no moment like the present to get started. There's never a better time to plant a tree than today. And I think that, we're here as information gatherers. We're here as opportunity identifiers, and we're here to live lives of service. And to the degree that we do those things, we live great lives.
Welcome back. I hope you've had an awesome week so far. If you haven't yet listened to my recent conversations with Simon Severino of Strategy Sprints and with leadership consultant and author of Visual Leadership, Todd Churches, then do check them out after you've listened to today's conversation. I'm really excited to have on the InnovaBuzz podcast as my guest today, Dr. Rick Kirschner, who is a best-selling author, and also he's the co-author of numerous books and multimedia programs, including the international bestseller, Dealing with People You Can't Stand, How to Bring Out the Best in People at Their Worst. Rick is a naturopathic physician. He's the president of the Naturopathic Medicine Institute, a longtime faculty member with the Institute for Management Studies, and a thought leader with Athena Interactive. He's worked with some of the world's best-known organizations, including Argonne National Laboratory, Heineken, NASA, Progressive Insurance, the U.S. Army, and the National Guard. In our conversation today, Rick talked to me about being of service to people with healthy communication. We talked about how art is the creative application of a skill and what we can learn from the punctuated equilibrium of nature. Without further ado, then, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Rick Kirschner. Hi, I'm your host, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited to welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast today from Idaho in the USA, Dr. Rick Kirschner, who's the creator and original developer of the Art of Change Skills for Life, which is a powerful approach to dealing with change that unlocks creativity, enhances team communication, and increases commitment. He's the author of numerous books, including The Insider's Guide to the Art of Persuasion, and together with Dr. Rick Brickman, he wrote the book Dealing with People You Can't Stand. And we did have Rick on the podcast on episode 292. So a big shout out to Rick as well. But welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, Dr. Rick Brickman. It's a real privilege to have you as a guest.
Thank you. I'm glad you got to talk to Rick Brickman. I listened to the podcast you did with him. It was really interesting. I hope I can add something to it. Nice to be with you.
Yeah. Well, thanks. And of course, it's Rick Kirschner, who we've got on today, and Rick Brinkman, so I've confused myself already.
Happens to us all the time.
Yeah. So now you've started out life as a naturopathic physician. Well, you didn't start out life as a naturopathic physician, but you started after you graduated from university as a naturopathic physician, and you then became a communication specialist, a speaker, and a book author. So why that transition?
Well, you know, this really all goes back to my third year in the four-year naturopathic medical school program. I was asked by my academic dean to appear on a TV program, a moderated forum with 90 invited guests on a topic. And that particular topic was alternatives in healthcare. And I was asked to go on the show to represent my school. And I remember asking my dean, why me? And he said, and his answer, by the way, turns out to be the answer to a lot of why me questions. No one else is available. So I went on this show. And I remember as they were starting the show, the moderator said, now, listen, if you have something you want to say, get your hand up early on, because the last 40 minutes of the show, everybody's going to have something they want to say. So I'm thinking, I don't know what I'm going to say, but I should get in the queue, right? So I put my hand up. And as he's starting the show, he interrupts himself doing the introduction and points at me. And now I have two cameras with shotgun microphones racing towards me. I totally blanked out. And yet my mouth spoke. And whatever I said impressed a doctor that was in the audience, an MD, physician and surgeon, head of the OBGYN department at a large Portland hospital. And for the next 3 weeks, he's calling me at a lab where I'm working in the afternoons to see if he can get a meeting with me. And I keep deflecting. I'm married. I got a kid at home, a little baby at home. I'm taking 25 credit hours a semester. I don't want anything else on my plate. And finally, the lab director said, you have to take this guy's call because it's annoying and we need to put an end to this. So I talked to him and he says, meet me for lunch. I have a job offer for you. I said, I'm not looking for work. He said, you haven't heard my offer. I said, I'm not interested. This goes on for about 8 minutes and finally says, I'll buy lunch. I said, can I bring classmates? Because you got to look out for your classmates.
Yeah.
And he says, yeah, I'll take care of it. Just meet me and hear what I have to say. So I brought Rick Brinkman with me and two other schoolmates. And those two ate and left. Rick stuck around with me. And this guy was really interesting. And he said that he wanted to hire me as his physician's assistant. And I said, I'm not interested. I want to be a naturopathic doctor, and I'm close to completion. I'm like a year and a half out. He said, well, then let me be your mentor. And I said, well, what would that entail? He said, I'm going to give you extracurricular things to read, to study. I'm going to send you to seminars. I'm going to give you audio things to listen to, and I'm going to engage with you and help you learn. And I said, what's it about? He said, communication. I said, why would I do this? And he said, look, there's two things you need to know that nobody's teaching you. I said, oh, yeah, what's that? He said, you need to learn how to listen and you need to learn how to talk. And I said, why? And he said, because most patients would get better if their doctor would just listen to them. And most doctors make their patients sick by the way they talk to them. And I was like, Eureka. It was what Tom Peters would call a blinding flash of the obvious. And so I took this on and Rick came with me and this guy sent us to all these things and gave us things to read. And we were like siblings competing all the time, which really drove us into learning things. And we were so amazed by the things we learned. We felt like we had an obligation to share it with our schoolmates. So we offered a workshop, and I still have the flyer from that workshop. We were so shy about it. We were like, we'll charge about $23. We wouldn't even name the price. And we required people to do a magic trick to take the course. And it was a 10-weekend program, and half the school showed up for it, and the other half felt terrible that they'd missed it. And they asked us to do it again. And somebody was attending with a friend from a neighboring chiropractic school who said, could you come and teach this here? I'm like, sure. So we go out and we teach it there. And somebody's visiting who's in the aerospace industry in California. He says, would you come teach this to my managers? I'm like, no, this is for doctors. He said, no, it's not. This is for everybody. We're like, Eureka, okay. So that's just kind of how the whole ball got rolling. And one thing led to another. And by 1987, 6.5 years after I got out of school, I had to make a decision. Do I keep practicing as a doctor, or do I go full time into public practice and speaking? Because it got harder and harder to tell my patients, if you can stay sick for 3 more weeks, I can see you. My speaking schedule got so full. So that's really how it all happened. And, you know, it's the great evidence of what Bucky Fuller called the side effects. You get more done by side effects than direct effects. If you look at your life, all these changes that happen in our life are side effects of things we thought were more important or thought we were going to do.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. And kudos to that doctor who kind of took you under his wing, and the impact that he's had is probably, I hope he realizes the impact he's had.
I'm pretty sure he's watched this from a distance over the last few years. He really did have an impact on our life. And, you know, the things we were learning really were transformative for Rick and I. It really reframed for us the way we paid attention to life, the way we paid attention to other people, the way we paid attention to ourselves. And it allowed us to kind of develop coherent models for change. And that's really, I kind of went off in my own direction with that when I started the Art of Change business, because I really wanted to focus on how do you create positive change, not just with patients, not just with management. I'm talking real change. What does it take to really get things to move in a better direction? And I got to tell you, it's I was inspired by the things I was learning, and I was excited to share them every step of the way. I retired at 67, so that would be 4 years ago. And I didn't miss it because I got tired of travel and I was happy to get off the road. But I probably talk to more people privately now than I ever did when I was in practice, because the things that I learned have such potent value for people. And people tell each other, you know, you got to talk to Rick. So I'm still busy, even though I'm in theory pretty much retired. I'm the president of an institute on the side, but.
Yeah. Well, we might come back to that one.
All right.
But the idea of communication, I'll come back again, the mentor's advice about learning to listen, and I like that you put that one first, and then learning to speak is key in medicine and helping patients get the result they desire. But then when you talked about change, and this is what the NASA person, who he probably recognized that this is not just communication is not just important in creating change and creating a desired outcome for a patient that's suffering from something.
That's right.
It's key to creating change for anyone. So talk to us a little bit about that transition from, you know, you were speaking to people in the medical profession broadly, I guess, and then you realized that, hey, this is something I can do to elicit change across the board in any arena.
Well, so, you know, it really gets back to why I wanted to be a doctor in the first place. I wanted to be useful with my life. I wanted to do something of service, something that would help others. I was raised that way. I've got a pretty strong value set that guides me in that direction. And I just saw that this material, this knowledge, this paradigm that I have cultivated in myself with these tools is conducive to that. I can be useful. I can be of service. I can really help people to be of service themselves. So, you know, I had the good fortune of working with Tom Peters many years ago, the co-author of In Search of Excellence. And Tom used to say, you know, if you don't serve well, you don't deserve to be in business, that the whole purpose of business is to serve others. No matter what it is, you're making widgets, that's to serve people. You're talking to people on the phone, that's to serve people. That's why you're in business. And if you don't serve well, you don't deserve to be in business. So that's the paradigm right there, that, you know, if we want to do something worthwhile with our lives, we want to facilitate change for the better.
Mm. Yeah, I love that. And that whole philosophy of service of it, that drives me to be of service. And also we talk about it's not what you sell, whether it's a service or a product, it's the change that you bring about. So that we talk about the transformation that you bring about for your customers. So taking them from where they are right now, which has got some undesirables to it, to where they want to be. And, you know, in the case of the medical example, there's an illness or an ailment or something that they're unhappy with related to their physical well-being, and you want to change that so that the ailment's gone, the illness is gone, or the well-being concerns are no longer there. And so is that how you came up with the art of change, or describe to us what you mean by the art of change? I mean, I think that's the change, but what's the art of change?
Well, let's see if I can pull this back out of my hat. Back in the day when I was actively running a business, I could just tell this to you right off the top of my head. So, you know, art is the creative application of skill to something. That's art, creative application of skill. And change is that transition from what we know to what we don't know, from what is to what is unknown. And for a lot of people, that transition from known to unknown comes with a great deal of anxiety and uncertainty. And people would rather not do it. They'd rather stick to what they know. You know, it's the devil you know versus the devil you don't know kind of thing. So the art of change is applying skill and imagination to moving from the known to the unknown. And it requires an internal skill set, you might say, of being able to be at peace with not knowing, with the beauty of doubt, with the willingness to reserve a place in your mind, no matter how certain you think you are, where I could be wrong. If you want to facilitate change with others, you always have to leave room for them being able to help you change. It's that transactional thing that happens between people, that you tell me something I never thought of, and now I am transformed by it. And here we thought I was here to tell you something, that kind of thing.
Hmm. So a lot of that is about listening and putting your ego aside and being open to possibilities.
It really is. And, you know, one of the things that I developed, and I developed some material on persuasion many years ago, and mostly because I was really curious about it, just wanted to learn everything I could about persuasion. So I did. And one day I was like, wow, I think I've got some models I can develop out of this. There's things I can do with this knowledge that I've got. So one of the things that I talked about was that when you're trying to persuade other people, there's four ways that could turn out. One is that they, you know, I say tomato, you say tomato, and at the end I say tomato and you say tomato. Nothing really changed. Another is I say tomato, you say tomato, and at the end of our interaction, you say, I say, you know what, let's agree that it's a piece of fruit. Another way it could turn out is that I say tomato, you say tomato, and at the end of our interaction, you go, you know what, I don't know what I was thinking, it's tomato. And the fourth way that it turns out is where all of a sudden I'm going, you know what, I think it's tomato. Where I'm transformed by it. So those are the four possible outcomes when you're in a persuasion interaction. And one of the things we know about business is you're almost always in a persuasion interaction. Whatever you're doing, you're trying to create something to make something happen. So that involves interacting with people in a way that somebody is moved towards some outcome.
Yeah, that's a fascinating example, and thinking of it in terms of, let's say, sales, and maybe this comes back to the concept of service, what you mentioned earlier. Some people have this idea of sales that it's all about persuading people that their approach is right, that, you know, buy my widget and you'll get this result. And there's still those four possible outcomes.
That's right.
But the salesperson is kind of like, no, you have to see my point of view.
Well, so, you know, I call that insistence. And what I like to say about insistence is that it creates resistance. That, you know, and you get the Ginsu knife. Let me tell you about the features, the benefits. And pressing and pressing and pressing and pressing. And you're talking to yourself that nobody likes to be sold on anything. But people do like to engage about all kinds of things. And if I can understand what your actual interest is, or your needs are, or your values are, and I have something that facilitates something that you care about, I don't have to work very hard at persuading you at all. I simply have to present it to you in a way that you recognize it. And you're like, oh, wow, that's exactly what I was looking for. That's taking me where I need to go. So to me, that whole idea of selling ought to be reframed to engaging. Because if what I have isn't something you need, I'd like to know that and save both of us a lot of time, save you the effort of my, you know, pushing whatever it is. I'd rather engage with you and find out, do I have something that can be useful to you?
Which comes back to the concept of how can I be of service, right?
Exactly.
And then listening. Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's take it back to those early days. And I think, I suspect, given that you're, you mentioned briefly that you're on the board of an organization right now, and that's the Professional Naturopaths Organization. I don't know if I've got the name right, but
it's the Naturopathic Medicine Institute. We are the preservers of the knowledge of our profession in a time of rapid change. So our job is to preserve, protect, present, and promote the vitalistic paradigm of naturopathic medicine, which is a very different paradigm to the conventional medical model that's employed around the world, thanks to the Rockefellers. So,
Okay. Well, thanks for clarifying that. Now, I guess there's a couple of questions I have in relation to communication with that, and I'm just repositioning it now in my own mind, because you've talked about the difference between naturopathic medicine and the traditional Western type medicine a GP type situation. But what you said very early on in our conversation today was, that doctors often make patients sicker by what they say to them,
yeah,
or don't help them heal by not listening to them. So talk to us a little bit about the whole idea of communication in the health industry right across the board.
Well, sure. So one of the main knocks, I think, on conventional medicine, I think my medicine is the traditional medicine and the modern system is the conventional system, but that's just a matter of linguistics, of semantics. But I think that the knock on the conventional system is that it is immune to feedback and it doesn't pay attention very well. It's kind of like wham, bam, here's your pill, go home. Or put you in a hospital, wham, bam, here's your procedure, we're done. And it's all kind of like, I'm in charge, you're the passive recipient of what I do. In naturopathic medicine, we partner with our patients. I can't make you get well, you can. I can help you learn what you need to do. I can help provide you with the resources you need to fulfill your own desire for health, but I can't make you a healthy person. Only you can make you a healthy person. So in our model of reality, our paradigm, we're not imposing our will on our patients. We're partnering with our patients to facilitate them restoring and maintaining their own health. So it's a very different model in treating sickness and, suppressing illness, which is what drugs and surgery basically do. If you take a pill and your pain stops, you're like, oh, I'm all better. No, you're not. You're taking a pill and your pain stopped. But what was that pain doing there? Why did you have it in the first place? In my model of medicine, we want to understand that pain, the purpose of it, and address it rather than just suppress it. So that's kind of a very different paradigm of healthcare, because it's actually organized around health and caring instead of sickness and suppression.
Yeah. And it's fascinating because that concept, I think, applies across the board in, treating, like if you say treating symptoms versus treating the underlying cause.
Exactly.
And I remember the, I had a serious bike accident about 10 years ago. Now I fractured my pelvis.
Oh.
And fractured pelvis, there's not much you can do about it, so that you can't put it in a cast or anything. So I was on crutches going up and down the stairs here at home, and I was given these very heavy painkillers, which I'm not a big fan of taking lots of painkillers. So I remember the second time I went for the checkup and they said, well, how's the pain? And I said, well, it's only when I come down the stairs on the crutches and, if I move funny that I get this jab of pain, and it's very unpleasant. It's painful. And the doctor said, well, why don't you just take some of the painkillers? Haven't you been taking the painkillers? And my response was, well, it's only when I walk down the stairs and it's telling me don't move like that.
That's it.
Because when you move like, and I said the pain probably comes from the fact that that the bones are crunching against one another where they're broken, and that's probably not good for them healing. So I figure the pain is telling me, don't move like that.
It's that old Henny Youngman joke where he says, "Doc, it hurts when I do this." He says, "Then don't do it."
So treating the underlying cause rather than symptoms, because I could have taken painkillers and then the pain wouldn't have been there. And the conclusion you could draw then is, hey, the healing's actually working, whereas that wasn't the case. You know, when you looked at it under the X-ray, it was actually taking a lot longer than originally expected, which was very frustrating for me. But
I'm sure. You know, I just a week and a half ago, I fell 6 feet off a ladder.
Ooh.
I did. My wife wasn't home. She just the day before, you know, we were packing up our house, trying to get ready for this move. We had all the smoke in the air because of the fires on the West Coast. And my wife saw me putting a ladder up improperly and told me, no. If you're going to use the ladder, you do it properly. You lock the arms down, you know, all of this. The very next day, she's away. I hear a beeping noise of some device that's on the deck that I'd forgotten to pack. I climb up on a ladder. I didn't open it. I just leaned it against the thing. I climbed to the very top of it, and I couldn't hear where the noise was coming. So I leaned a little too far to the right, and the ladder went to the left, and bam. And I hit so hard, like a sack of potatoes, hurt like crazy. I just, bam. I landed on the back of my shoulder and on my hip. I'm 71 years old as of 2 days ago. Typically, that kind of fall, you break your wrist, maybe you break your hip, maybe you break your or tear your rotator cuff. You know, there's all these normal things that happen. None of that happened for me. I don't know how I survived that thing. Maybe an angel caught me. I really don't know how I'm not dead, because I didn't even hit my head on the pavement. Because if I would have, I'm pretty sure I would have bled out. My wife wasn't home for another 30 minutes. And instead, I called in the house. I took a homeopathic medicine called Arnica. And I applied, I did what's called hydrotherapy. I used hot and cold to get circulation to all the places that I could. I did a few other things. And here I am. And it's like hardly, I have a little pain, but I have full range of motion and all of that. So the doc who examined me said, "Well, here's what we've learned about you. You're not fragile." And I was like, "Well, I think that's a good thing at my age, right?" He says,
yeah,
it really is. So the question becomes, you know, how is it possible that I could fall that far, hit that hard, and still be so functional and not break something? And I think I've been making really great choices about my health based on the things that I learned when I was in school. For all of these years, and it paid off. There was a moment in time, week and a half ago, I was like, "Wow, I'm really glad I made all those choices, because we've got to finish packing."
Yeah, well, just secure the ladder next time.
My wife has forbidden me to ever get on a ladder again unless she's holding it.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I think there's probably a lesson in that story in terms of taking care of yourself and taking care of the fundamentals in good times. And then if something untoward happens, then, you know, the impact might be a lot less. And, you know, that's, I'm thinking kind of in terms of business, let's say. So sound businesses right now are probably in better positions with the pandemic and the resultant impact that's had on all our lives and shutdowns and lack of travel and so on, than businesses that have had issues prior to that.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, what is it that Darwin said? He said that, you know, survival does not go to the strongest nor the most intelligent, but the organism that is most adaptive to change. So we're living in a time where everything has moved, everything has changed. And if you're paying attention to what's changing and you're adapting to it instead of resisting it, hating it, or trying to do things the way you've always done them, you're probably better positioned right now than all those who have been, you know, scrambling after what was or dreading what's coming. And I know quite a few people who have successfully adapted to this crazy time in the world and are doing really well in their business. And I attribute it to them being highly adaptive, or in the words I would have used 20 years ago, resourceful. You know, yep. instead of just sitting and reacting to things, you try to get ahead of it. You know, there's a thing in biology called punctuated equilibrium. And it's the basic idea that things pulse. Everything in nature kind of has a pulse, whether it's the atmosphere of the Earth or the planets in the solar system, or you're just talking about the waves of the ocean coming on the shore and then sweeping away and then coming on the shore and then sweeping away. And we work the same way because we are a part of nature, not apart from nature. So our nerves work the same way, for example. They don't just fire and continue firing on. They go on, off. On, off. That's the way our heartbeat. Whew, whew. It's not shh. So everything has this in nature has this punctuated equilibrium. Now, what's the value of knowing that? Well, if you're a surfer, you know that you don't waste your time scrambling after the wave that went by you. You spend your time getting in position to catch the next wave. You use the off to get ready for the on instead of always trying to be on. So I think that idea of punctuated equilibrium fits here because it's really being resourceful in the off moments. You know, business shut down, right? All across the planet. All kinds of businesses just came to a screeching halt. That's an off. The wise business person goes, hey, I got an off here. Time to be resourceful. Time to kind of chart the trend, see where things might go. Be adaptive to what is changing. I think businesses that do that are thriving right now.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a great analogy, the pulse of nature. And it really highlights for me. I mean, I was always annoyed or frustrated by the people, and there's a lot of this going on in the news, and I guess it's sort of more newsworthy, people saying, well, we've got to open up, we've got to open up the borders, we've got to get more flights in, we've got to bring tourists back in to bring the tourism industry, and we've got to get back to normal. And well, what is normal, first of all? And secondly, you know, opening the borders isn't necessarily going to change people's behavior. The tourists who, you know, brought in the dollars before, they're not suddenly going to go back to their normal behavior, because there's going to be changes that you cannot mandate back to where it was before. And so what have you learned? And I'm thinking, yeah, those businesses haven't got it, because they're probably not going to survive even if it does open up earlier. And yeah,
they're counting on it going back to what was. And in life, nothing goes back to what was. Everything keeps going. Change keeps happening. It happens to us, through us, with or without us. It's the nature of life has changed. It's the nature of relationships has changed. It's the nature of everything. So I think that you're right. I think those businesses that are trying to get back to what was are going to find themselves in worse shape as time progresses. And organizations that are looking at the world we're in instead of the world we used to be in and adapting to it wisely, making good use of your resources, figuring out, you know, where do we have some intelligence in our organization that we can apply to this, maybe do, you know, think our way through some of this. There's opportunity in our environment all the time, but opportunity doesn't always knock. So you got to be paying attention for it.
That's right. Who was it that said opportunity sometimes missed because it's often dressed in overalls and looks like hard work?
There it is. I love that.
Okay. Now, so let's touch on the book Dealing with People You Can't Stand, because I mentioned to you before we started recording that when I had your co-author, Rick Brinkman, on, I was preparing for that, I thought, something seems familiar about Rick, but I'd never met him. And then I realized that I had a copy of Dealing with People You Can't Stand in my bookshelf from back in the late 1980s or early 1990s, and had read it in my corporate career and had sort of parked it. And I thought, oh, okay, that's really cool. So how did having that bestseller, or writing that bestseller and having it become a bestseller, impact your life?
oh my gosh, you know, it's the gift that keeps on giving. I'm still getting royalty payments from the third revised edition, the iTunes enhanced edition, the Kindle version, you know. Difficult people is a perennial problem, not an annual problem. So it keeps coming back around. And especially right now, I think there's a lot of bad behavior happening. In fact, you see it on social media, a lot of bad behavior. People take the liberty of being hateful because they're by themselves when they're saying whatever the mean thing is. So the way it impacted my life, first and foremost, was it opened a heck of a lot of doors. That book really just opened doors for Rick and I like crazy in our career. Dealing with People You Can't Stand took us all over the world. We did speaking tours in, you know, Asia, Australia, all over the world. So I got to see a lot of the world thanks to that book. And I have to say, and we had, you know, the kind of publicity and PR that any book author would practically die for. We were on the front page of the Marketplace section of the Wall Street Journal. We were in every major newspaper when the book first came out in 1994. It was amazing. And it was really a collaboration. Rick and I really put our heads together to sort all that out and really kind of get it organized where it was coherent, made a lot of sense. And it taught us a lot as we were doing it that we've used for all of our lives. There are some principles in there. I know Rick talked to you about some of them, some of the wonderful keys in there to having better relationships with people at their worst. So on the, you know, financially, it was great for me. As a human being, it was great for me because it really expanded my horizons, having a successful book like that. And I would say that on a psycho-emotional level, the book was transformative as well, because, you know, I've been asked why we even bothered to write a book like that. And the answer is we were asked to. But it was really relevant to me. When I was a kid, I didn't know much. In fact, I didn't know anything. And I got bullied a lot. I deal with a lot of bad behavior growing up. I took it all very personally. I had very thin skin for the first, you know, part of my life, right up through my teen years. To learn what I could have done different when I was a kid was amazing, where all of a sudden all these memories that haunt you become training ground where you can practice new skills and go, oh, wow, that would be totally different. So I feel like it made me a much better person and made it possible for me to meet the incredible wife that I have and for her to stay with me now for all of these years. We've been together for 33 years. It really helped me evolve as a human being into a calmer, more rational, more reasonable person in all kinds of circumstances. It's a gift that keeps on giving in every possible way.
Amazing. And as I say, it's in my bookshelf, still in my bookshelf. I've revisited it recently when I was about to talk with Rick, and it's still as relevant today as when it was written.
And you know, it also serves as a useful shield, because if somebody comes in and you don't want to deal with them, just hold that thing up.
yeah, I hadn't thought of using it in that way, but yeah, could work. Yeah. All right. Now, you mentioned earlier, I mean, we kind of touched on the Naturopathic Medicine Institute that you're heading up, I believe. And so what is that all about? You talked a little bit about preserving the knowledge and being the repository of knowledge for the naturopathic medicine. So what do you do there, and why do you do it?
Well, so first of all, I should say how I wound up getting pulled into this thing. I love the Institute. I'm very proud of my involvement with it. I hope I'm doing some good as with my position there. You know, the naturopathic profession has been around for over a century. And I made a documentary about this actually a few years ago, a movie documentary about it, about the history of medicine. And right at the time that my profession was born, which would be 1906, John D. Rockefeller was beginning to take over the entire medical system and in his own image. Rockefeller was behind the World Health Organization, and Rockefeller was behind pretty much everything you can name, all the hospitals that exist today. Mm. All of this stuff came out of Rockefeller. And right at that very same moment in time, before they had gotten control of everything, a fellow named Benedict Lust came to the United States on a mission to bring health and healing to this incredible country. And he wanted it to be made of the best practices of natural medicine. And because natural medicine was the medicine for the human race until a century ago, you know, people used herbs, they used nutrition, they used water, they used all these natural agents to maintain their health. I know a lot of people seem to think that everybody died at the age of 36 before 100 years ago, but that's actually not true. The weak died and the strong survived and so on and so forth. But you could do things to keep yourself healthy and protect yourself against illness and infection. And you could do it with natural medicine. So Rockefeller basically converted the whole system over to pharmaceutical products, you know, chemical products, because he was in the oil business. Anything you could make out of oil was good for him. So he basically made that shift. So our profession was pretty much marginalized, not because it didn't, our medicine didn't work, but we didn't have Rockefeller's money to build our institutions and do the research and all the stuff that the conventional system was able to do, because it had this, you know, all this money just pouring into it. And yet we survived. We're still here over 100 years later. And how's that possible? They tried to get rid of us. They actually called us names and bought newspapers to attack us and all of this over 100 years. The reason we're still here is because medicine still works and people still love natural medicine. And more people in this time in the history of the world are drawn to natural medicine because they've had so many bad experiences with the conventional system. You know, they took the drugs weren't everything they were promised, and they had side effects. They had the procedure didn't really deliver what was promised, and they have side effects. And a lot of the patients that come to naturopaths are actually driven to seek an alternative because the conventional system hurt them or failed them completely. So the Institute provides continuing education to naturopathic doctors in the vital core of our profession. The old medicine, the stuff that works, the herbs that work, the nutrition that works, all that stuff goes back a long ways. We have held on to it, developed it, and provide continuing education for it. It's a trend that is happening now in our own schools is that they are kind of looking for money, right? So the medical industry and the drug industry come to our schools and offer them money if they'll change this or do that a little different, or we'll buy you a clinic on Barber Boulevard if you're willing to do certain kinds of practices. And as a result, there's been some drift in the naturopathic profession in the United States of America towards the conventional system. And a lot of the new docs coming out of the schools really don't understand the vitalistic paradigm, and they don't know how to practice in it, and they don't have confidence in it because the schools haven't been able to deliver for them. So we're filling that gap and training the teachers that will go back into the schools at a future moment of now and bring up another generation of naturopaths.
Mm. Fascinating. Yeah. Yeah. It's unfortunate that there's this conflict between the new medicine, the pharmaceutical based medicine, if you like, and the naturopathic medicine. And I know in Australia that since last year, I think all the private health industries by government regulation now no longer pay rebates for most natural medicines. I think there's some that are still exempt that are recognized. And the argument is that there's no scientific evidence, which I thought was hilarious.
It is hilarious. It's
as a trained industrial chemist and proper scientist, I'd like to say, controversially here, I was always amused at the medical profession, so the conventional medical profession as taught in universities, that they would bring out this research and say, well, you know, there's so many people have responded positively to this drug, and so therefore it works. And it was always, well, you know, how many people got the placebo, and and you know, how did you discount the psychological effects of somebody taking a tablet and healing themselves as a result of convincing themselves that this was good for them, or all of that. And I thought, you know, there really isn't that much science behind that. It's not.
Well,
really,
they say, from what I've been able to ascertain, probably half of the published research is not true. It's not accurate. It's not true. It's extrapolations and correlations. You know, what do they say in good science? Correlation does not equal causation. But in published science, quite often correlation is all you're getting there. And, you know, I think, what is it they say? Believe half of what you see and none of what you hear. You really need to test all the assumptions. And one of the things that a lot of people don't know about, especially American naturopathic doctors, is we are scientifically trained. We learn all the same basic sciences. The difference is our medicine, the way we treat. We don't treat to suppress. We treat to restore health. That's a different paradigm. And in the conventional system, restoring health is not the prime directive. It's whatever you came in complaining about. If I can make you stop complaining, that's a benchmark of success. In my reality, if you don't walk out healthier and happier because of the work we've done together, I didn't really deliver for you.
Yeah. And I think there's, you know, to me, that really comes back to the whole core of the business. I can sell you my product, and then I can say, yes, that's a success. But unless you've achieved the result that you wanted to achieve, and achieved the result that was the reason why you bought my product or my service, then I've actually failed, even though I've made the sale. So, you know, that to me is the service-based mentality.
It really is. And, you know, one of the things that our doctors discover when they go in, a lot of our docs, when they get out of school, they try to get positions working in clinics with conventional doctors. First of all, that allows more to happen than if you're on your own because of the way the laws are structured. If you've got an MD looking over your shoulder, somehow you can do more. But the kind of the generalization I would make from all the feedback I've heard from docs who've the young docs who've done this is that the medical system is not as smart as it pretends to be. When I was a kid, the smartest people in our society were doctors and astronauts. That's, you know, if you want to be the cream of the crop, be a doctor or an astronaut. And a lot of people find out they're not that smart. It's kind of cookbook medicine, you know, tag it and bag it. As soon as I can put a name on it, I look it up, I give you that drug for it. We don't operate that way. We're really interested in the cause of problems. We're interested in treating the cause of problems, and we're interested in doing so to restore health. And just imagine what the world would be like today if the medical system had that as its prime directive instead of profit. The truth is that we have built a medical system that is driven to make money, and does. It extracts tremendous amounts of wealth out of the economies of the world. It's highly rewarding if you're in the drug industry, which I believe is one of the most profitable industries on earth, even though its reputation before COVID was one of the worst reputations on earth because of all of its failures and all the death and destruction it's caused. So I think that, you know, a lot of our docs, when they work with the conventional doctors, they come away going, well, that's not the cream of the intellectual crop right there. I think I actually know something they don't know. So.
Yeah. I'm not sure this is completely accurate. It's something that I read somewhere once, and I thought, well, that's actually a really cool model, that the Chinese back in the day of Confucius, or maybe earlier than that, that the doctors there were paid if you were healthy, not if you were sick. So they didn't get paid when you came to the doctor and said, I've got this ailment, I need treatment. They were paid if you didn't have to come to the doctor for treatment. They were paid because you were healthy. So that then the whole philosophy, of course, and the whole objective that they had in order to make money and make a living was to ensure that you are healthy, not to just see you when you became sick.
It would be amazing if that's the way the medical system of the world worked. And, you know, I have to say, I think there's a time and a place for everything. It's just not all the time in every place. So, you know, there's a time and a place for a drug. There's a time and a place for a surgical procedure. I'm not against those things. But to me, those should be last resorts instead of first resorts, because if we can get you back to health, that has the higher return for society.
Hmm.
So, you know, this is one of those things where a lot of times I feel like I'm talking into the wind, but I still feel driven by purpose in it. I feel like it's, you know, important work, and I'm really proud of the work the Institute does, and I encourage all of your listeners to check out the Naturopathic Medicine Institute, because we're doing some very good things, and we appreciate all the support we can get.
Mm, great. Well, we'll include some links to that in the show notes.
Thank you.
It's been fabulous, Rick. We've kind of covered lots of different areas. I sort of occasionally link back to general business principles, because I think there are lessons here in your experience on the whole idea of change, and also the concepts around, you know, what the philosophy is behind the naturopathic medicine and the idea of addressing symptoms before they become problems rather than putting band-aids on the problems, to use a metaphor. I think it's a good time now, though, to move on to the buzz, which is our innovation round. So it's designed to help our audience, who are primarily innovators and leaders in their field, with some tips from your experience. So there's five questions, and hopefully you'll give us answers that'll inspire the listener to do something awesome today as a result.
All right.
So what's the number one thing you think anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
That's easy. I'd say make useful assumptions. You know, there's two kinds of assumptions you can make, and you're going to make assumptions. Everybody makes assumptions. My wife brought a book home one time called The Four Agreements, and the first agreement was make no assumptions. And she showed it to me and said, "What do you think about that?" And I said, "That author is assuming I could do that."
Yeah.
We make assumptions. So there's two kinds of assumptions. There's limiting assumptions. Those are the ones where you get to be right and nothing good comes from it. The kind of assumptions that tie you up, hold you back, and trap you into self-defeating, counterproductive thought and behavior. And then there's the useful assumption, which is all about having informed perspective. And that's where listening comes in, right? Where the more you know, the more you can do with what you know. So to me, making useful assumptions is the beginning of wisdom when it comes to creating change with people, when it comes to being innovative. And at its simplest level, the assumption that, sure, I could do this, has way more value than, I don't think I can do this.
Hmm. Yeah, that's great. I love that. And checking that it is an assumption that actually serves you, and being curious about the impact that that might have on both you and your environment.
Absolutely.
Hmm. All right. What's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
Oh, gosh. I take hot tubs. For whatever reason, I have so many good ideas when I'm in a hot tub. But, you know, the key to a good idea is to do something about it. If you just have an idea and let it go by, it's like, well, wasn't that entertaining? What's on TV? So for me, if I have a good idea, I write it down. I actually keep something by my bed to write. If I wake up in the middle of the night with an idea, I write it down. It may not make sense to me in the morning, but maybe it will. And I don't want to take the chance of missing it. So that's for me, anything that causes you to totally relax and get into your sort of that right brain, what they used to call the right brain, even though I don't think that's anywhere near accurate, but anything that you can get totally relaxed and be present in your life, you're most likely to have an aha or to realize something that you had never thought of before. So that's what the hot tub is for me, a place to just let go of the world and be in the moment.
Yeah, that's fascinating. There's most of my guests have an answer like that. I mean, not the hot tub, I think, might be the first one, but it's an answer that basically says, if you relax and do something that takes you away from the day-to-day humdrum and allows your mind to just chill and allows things to bubble up from the unconscious, that's when those ideas pop up. I like the idea of really writing them down. I mean, I started writing down when I wake up in the middle of the night with some thought. I started writing it down because I realized that I couldn't get back to sleep if I didn't get it out of my head and didn't convince myself that it would be there in the morning. And so I'd sort of be awake half the night thinking, I've got to try to remember this brilliant idea.
Yeah, I think you know, capturing information is important. Otherwise, it just floats on by in one hemisphere and out the other when it comes to your brain. So you gotta capture it somehow. And I think writing it down, especially in the middle of the night, has great value.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now, do you have a favorite resource you use most often?
Well, since I retired, no, I can't say that I do. I use the human resource. I talk with people. That's probably where I learn the most. I get the most information. That's how I get a reality check on the world. I talk with people. And when I talk with people, I try to do good listening.
Hmm. Yeah. That's consistent with what you've been telling us around all the change and listening to people and taking in that information. Okay. And what's the best way to keep a client on track?
Well, so, you know, the challenge in life is that everybody knows what they don't want, but change happens when you know what you do want. And once you know what you want, you can keep staying relevant to what you want. So anytime something wanders off, you say, you know, it's my understanding, this is where we're trying to go. How is that relevant to this? And just tie it back to this. And if you do that with people, it helps them stay on track instead of following down the bunny trail of whatever random thing popped into their mind.
How do you do that? Because there's this philosophy that, you know, there's the people who are motivated by and away from. So here's something that I don't like and I don't want, and my motivation is, as soon as I see that, I run in the opposite direction. Whereas there's people that are motivated differently, so they look in that direction and they say, there's what I'm going for, and I'm going to run towards that. So how do you kind of change that mindset for those people that are with that away from motivated?
Well, so, you know, it's really interesting you bring that up, because I think motivation comes down to fear and desire. That's it. You know what you don't want, or you know what you do want. And the most motivated people in the world know both. And the least motivated people in the world only know what they don't want. And then there are people who do really stupid things because all they know is what they don't want. They don't moderate it with a little fear. So I think a lot of desire and a little bit of fear is the highest form of motivation. Knowing what you don't want can push you on days when you don't want to do something, but you don't want something bad to happen. So it's the kick in the rear when you don't want to do something. But if you're kicking yourself all the time, you're going to wear yourself out and be exhausted. So you got to know what you're moving towards. So if somebody tells me what they don't want, I've got a couple of choices if I'm being resourceful. And one of those is to frame something in terms of, okay, here's how to not get that. Just work with that. To be on track. What do you want today? I want to not da 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 da. All right. Well, it's my understanding you want to not. So how is that relevant to not da da? So I could work with that away from. But I always like to play with the idea of, if you don't want that, what do you want? And to stick with that until I have a desired outcome clearly identified. Bucky Fuller talked about how humanity's entire history consists of backing into the future, fighting or withdrawing from what we don't want. And that this whole creation of our civilization is basically us problem solving and fixing what we don't want, rather than stopping and facing the future and saying, what is the future I want to live in? And what steps can I take today that lead me to that future? He thinks that he used to talk about that when humanity finally grows up, it will do this. It will face the future and go, well, let's create the future that we want instead of backing into it, fighting and withdrawing from what we don't want. So I think, you know, it just depends on the client. You can work with them if they're really committed to the away from motivation. You can still frame things in terms of, all right, if you don't want that, you know, how is that relevant to this? Or if you don't want that, what steps can we take today to make sure that doesn't happen? Or you can really spend time with people, because it is the more time consuming choice, but totally worth it. And say, all right, if you don't want that, what is it you do want?
And then, of course, listening. listening.
And then listening to the answer, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Fabulous. And finally, what's the number one thing anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
Well, so first thing you got to know is there's only one of you. Every single one of us, all of us have this in common. We're all completely unique. We can't be duplicated. Even if they ever figured out the cloning thing and got it perfectly, you know, where we can make a clone of you, Jürgen, where we just make 10 of you, none of them could possibly be you because they haven't had the experiences that made you who you are. So everybody is unique. And if you value yourself, and you value what makes you unique, then you go, okay, what's fulfilling to uniqueness that I am, and do that. So I'm pretty sure that's how we got to this podcast for you. Am I right? It's like, you know, this is who I am. This is what makes me unique. I want to do this. This is fulfilling to me. So I believe that a life lived with purpose is a life well lived. I've tried to stay true to that for my whole adult life. I tried to pass that on to my daughter. And to as many people as I can. So I believe that knowing your purpose, knowing what really fulfills you in life is the way to differentiate yourself because there's only one of you.
Hmm. Yeah, great advice. Be really clear about what fulfills you and what you enjoy. All right. Well, thanks, Rick. This has been really fabulous. Now, where can people find out more about you and maybe even get in touch to say thanks for what you've shared today?
Well, you can write to me at president@thevitalnd.org. That's president@thevitalnd.org.
Great. And we'll include that in the show notes. Now, do you have any parting advice for our listener today?
You know, I guess if I'm leaving some parting advice, it would be this, that there's people that watch things happen. There's people that make things happen. There's people always going, what happened? I think that a life well lived is the life where you make things happen instead of waiting for things to happen. There's no moment like the present to get started. There's never a better time to plant a tree than today. And I think that, we're here as information gatherers. We're here as, opportunity identifiers, and we're here to live lives of service. And to the degree that we do those things, we live great lives. And I wish a great life to all of your listeners.
Wonderful. Well, thanks for that. All right. Well, and finally, who else should I get on this podcast and have a conversation with, and why?
You're asking the wrong guy right now. I can barely remember where my address book is. So.
Well, we might come back to you then when you've unpacked your address book. All right. Well, thanks so much, Rick. This has been fun. I've really enjoyed it. And, you know, hopefully we've got lots of lessons here from your experience in naturopathic medicine and communication and how that applies in the medical field, but also how it applies across the board in all of business. So I think there were lots of great lessons here. So I wish you all the best for the future, and let's stay in touch.
Thank you. I really enjoyed the conversation.
I hope you enjoyed that insightful and informative conversation with Rick and found something of value in what he shared. Rick's focus on service, on clarity of communication, as well as paying attention, were evident in all that he shared with us today. I'd love to know what you took away from Rick's episode. Do leave a comment below the blog post, which you can find at innovabiz.co/Rick Kirschner. That is RickKirschner. All lowercase, all one word, innovabiz.co/Rick Kirschner. You'll also find contact information for getting in touch with Rick there, as well as links to his website, his books, his social media pages, and the other resources we spoke about in today's conversation. Rick suggested that we have a conversation with Aidan Nepom from Art of Change and science journalist and book author Jennifer Margulis on future InnovaBuzz podcast episodes. So Aidan and Jennifer Keep an eye on your inboxes for an invitation from us to the InnovaBuzz podcast, courtesy of Dr. Rick Kirschner. Tune in again to the next episodes of the InnovaBuzz podcast, where we've got even more fantastic guests lined up, including Jason Case of The Pulse Spot and author Ed Cressy. Thanks for listening to this episode. Make sure you subscribe to the show to be reminded of new episodes. It's free to subscribe. Leave a review if you like. Even if you don't like me, I'm okay with that. I'm asking you to leave a review because it helps other people find this show. Go to innovabiz.co to join our marketing transformation community and access a free gift my team and I made for you. It's the Marketing Master Mini Class. We want to give you everything you need to transform your marketing into a human-centered, relationship-focused growth engine. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember, be awesome and keep innovating.